I might say this this statement here hanging, I don't know if you can read it from where you are, is a statement of ethics, and it is my contention, and I've contended this for some time in our country, that it's unethical not to state your ethics. You must hang your ethics up so that people know where you stand on major issues, because no longer can people assume that we adhere to a Hippocratic Oath, and many patients are not aware of the fact that there are no medical schools I know of anywhere that actually have their young people to swear by a Hippocratic Oath. There are oaths, but they are very much modified and adapt to almost any philosophical point of view. This is a Christian oath, and I hang it in my office, and people read it, and some shake their heads in dismay, and I've never seen them again. But the vast majority of people look at that, and whether they agree or not, they're glad to know where I stand on certain important issues. So it is my contention that it's unethical not to state your ethics. You must hang them somewhere in your office or your waiting room and make sure that people have an opportunity to read them. Now, what I would like to do this evening is to talk about what is termed the post-abortion syndrome. We'll talk about the connection between child abuse and abortion, talk about abortion survivors, and a little bit about how you treat this horrendous difficulty. I also want to put this in the context of science. It is important for you to know that I feel strongly about science, and I became a psychologist after I became a psychiatrist, which is somewhat unusual because I was interested in science, and I do my research carefully. And I thank the Lord that it's been published in reputable journals. And maybe you could just hold up that folio there. There's a folio of articles that you may want to pass that around and just see if there's anything there that's of interest to you. There are articles on ethics, articles on abortion, articles on child abuse, predominantly child abuse, and articles in there by my wife, and I'm sorry she's not here. My wife, in fact, is a very famous pediatrician. She is the author of many papers on the biochemical aspects of Down syndrome. She knows probably more about Down syndrome than anybody else in the world. In any case, let's look at this issue of what is called post-abortion syndrome. I am increasingly not using the term because there is, in fact, a continuum of all pregnancy losses. That is to say, the conflicts that surround a woman who's had an abortion are not totally different from women who have other kinds of pregnancy losses. And the issues are really one of to what extent do you welcome a child and how much then do you have to grieve a child. There's an inverse relationship between grief and welcome. And you can understand that in some parts of the world, necessarily China, they welcome the baby, but they are forced to abort the baby. And so that's on part of the spectrum. And then there are other people who have stillbirths or miscarriages, and it's not as if they aborted the baby. In fact, they may be strongly against abortion, but throughout their pregnancy they wish they weren't pregnant. In fact, some patients wish their baby would die. And of course, just the fantasy that you're wishing the baby die and now you have a miscarriage or a stillbirth contributes to complicated grief. And so there is this wide spectrum, and so we now talk about pregnancy loss syndrome rather than post-abortion syndrome. And that has a variety of good features, of course, that helps people deal with the problem without feeling that they have to deal with an abortion, which is still a difficult word to utter. The other thing that I want to say is that I want to put this in the context of medicine and the practice of medicine. And I'll say this at the outset, and probably say at the end, just to reinforce the fact that there is no evidence to support the current practice of abortion. There is no psychiatric indications for abortion stated in standard psychiatric textbooks. There are no physical indications, no surgical indications, no medical indications, and certainly no surgical social indications to support the practice of abortion. It has always been in the history of medicine that the burden of proof lies with those who support, perform, or in any way promote a procedure to show beyond any reasonable doubt that it is both safe and effective. That has never been done with respect to abortion. It's a practice that has gone beyond the bounds of current medical practice in every other area and is in fact not medical practice. And why any government in any part of the world should support it, I don't know, because no government in any part of the world that I know of supports elective surgery, and this in fact is elective surgery. It's not supported by medical indications. Now, I want you to understand that, because it puts the whole area of abortion in a place where it should be studied scientifically. And it is not my responsibility to say abortion is not a good practice and that there's harm done. It is the responsibility of those who perform the abortion and those who support it by paying for it to convince me and convince you beyond any reasonable doubt that it is both safe and effective. They have never, never taken that responsibility seriously. And they must be consistently, constantly confronted. Where is the evidence for what you're doing? Where is the benefit that it accrues to mothers? Where is the safety? Now, if a surgeon was doing any other kind of surgical procedure, he would not dare to do this on patients, and the government would not dare to fund it until he had been able to prove in animal studies that it is safe and effective. So what would he do in this area? You'd have 500 guinea pigs, and you'd randomly abort them at different stages of their pregnancy, and then follow them up to see what are the damages, physiological and psychological. You can do psychological studies on animals. But the people who perform and support abortions have never taken that responsibility. And it is time they be confronted with the necessity of looking at the need to demonstrate this. Where is the evidence? Where is the evidence that it does a woman any good? In fact, if you do that, you'll find that they will sort of talk about, well, what about in cases of rape? And I say, fine, what about cases of rape? Where is the evidence that it does good in cases of rape? They don't have any. What about incest? Good idea. Where is the evidence that it's good and beneficial to any woman in instances of incest? So you can see that the burden of proof, which lies with those who perform abortion and governments who support it in any way, the burden of proof lies with them to demonstrate that it is both safe and effective. To date, that has not been done. And as I said, in the area of psychiatry, psychiatric illnesses are contraindicated. They are precisely why you don't do an abortion. All the psychiatric illnesses we know are made worse by abortion. And that's stated in standard psychiatric textbooks. And one of the social indications, of course, were unwanted children. And the cry was, if we had a freely available abortions, there wouldn't be any unwanted children, and if there was no unwanted children, there wouldn't be much child abuse. Is there evidence to support that? Absolutely not. In fact, the evidence is quite the contrary. In every country I know, where there are more abortions, there is more child abuse. And in our country, where they have introduced abortions, the rate of child abuse went up parallel to the number of abortions. And many, many years ago, this got me to thinking, I wonder if there is a correlation between child abuse and abortion. Indeed, we'll talk about that later. The point is that there are no psychiatric indications for abortion, there are no social indications for abortion, there are no medical indications for abortion, there are no surgical indications for abortion. If you don't believe me, listen to a statement from the professors of gynecology and obstetrics. In Ireland, all four medical schools there, the professors of obstetrics and gynecology say there are no reasons to do abortion, physical or surgical. Anyhow, having said that, now let's look at the study we did. One of the studies we did was on a sample of women who come to see their family doctors, and so there are relatively a random representative sample. In fact, we checked their demographics with the demographics of our country, and it looks like the sample we have are fairly typical of all the women in Canada. These are women who are coming to see their family doctors for headaches, backaches, colds, etc. They're not coming because they have any difficulty with abortion. They fill in a brief questionnaire while they're sitting in the waiting room of their family doctor. The receptionist collects this, and we get the data and analyze it. This is a fairly large sample, 1,432 women. It's now been expanded to data that we've collected from five countries to over 4,000 women. It's been published in a reputable journal, the Journal of Social Sciences and Medicine. And this is what we found. First, the overhead. We need a medical student to do the overheads. Isn't that what they use medical students for in this country? No. Man, things have changed. Well, till we find the power, I'll keep talking. Okay, we'll take it from the top. All right. This is an indication of the people in our sample, and it shows you the breakdown of pregnancy outcomes by age groups. And what you recognize right away is that the number of abortions for teenagers is relatively much higher for that than older age groups. And the abortion rate diminishes with time, and the miscarriage rate goes up in time. And that obviously must spark a few questions. But if you look in the teenage group, go right to the bottom of that overhead. Can you see it all right? It's reasonably focused. If you go right to the bottom, you will see that if you subtract the number of abortions from teenage pregnancies, teenagers have as many full-term normal birth weight pregnancies as any other age group. That is to say, teenage is not a reason to have an abortion. And teenagers are able to have pregnancies and full-term pregnancy outcomes. It's not a reason to abort babies. I'm not promoting teenage pregnancies, but it is a fact that they can have as many as other age groups full-term normal birth weight babies. All right, next one, please. Now, the question we really were looking at, is there any connection between the number of pregnancy losses or the type of pregnancy losses and a woman's health? And we were looking at 66 factors. And when you do a stepwise regressive analysis and ask the computer which are the most important factors that determine a woman's general health, this is her physical health, remember, these are the first three factors. None of that surprises you at all. The quality of her family life, previous losses, and the amount of partner support. These are important factors that determine a woman's health. So now we narrow down on the issue of previous losses. Next one, please. Yeah, medical students aren't bad at this after all. So there you look at the range of different kinds of pregnancy losses and see how it's connected with the type of health. When we looked at the general health of the woman, we asked her to rate her own health. We also asked the physician, the family doctor, to rate the woman's health. And we also had an independent rater. So we had a three-way rating of general health. And what you find is that if you compare various kinds of pregnancy losses, the abortion has a much greater connection to poor health than other kinds of pregnancy outcomes. And if you're not familiar with statistics, then look for lots of zeros. Lots of zeros mean this is not likely to be a happenstance. This is a real connection. So it looks like if you compare miscarriages to abortions or stillbirths, it looks like, for whatever reason, abortions have a greater impact on a woman's negative impact on a woman's general health. Now, if that's the case, it's very important for governments to note this, because you've got to remember that abortions are the most frequent surgical procedure in every Western country I know. So there are many, many kinds of abortions, and even if the fact of a small diminution of general health, it means a great increase to the global health budget. So here's evidence that abortion has a bad impact on a woman's health. And you ask yourself, what is the connection? And these are the connections. A woman who has an abortion must grieve. The reason is that every woman has an attachment, a physiological attachment, to every pregnancy. That's a physiological fact. And what happens in the body is recorded in the mind, like the black box of a 747. It's not only recorded in the mind, it's reinforced in the mind. So every woman is attached to every pregnancy. And every woman who is attached both physiologically and psychologically to every pregnancy must grieve when she has an abortion. You cannot not grieve. Grieving is a very natural, a normal process, and if you don't grieve, there are consequences. Now, I'll try and persuade you that grieving an abortion is more difficult than any other kind of grief known to humans, for a wide variety of reasons. In any case, if you don't have a normal grief, you have what is known in psychiatry as a pathological grief. That is, a grief never really gets started, never ends. If you have a pathological grief, you're more likely to have a depression. If you are depressed, modern science has shown it interferes with your immune system. If your immune system is not functioning well, what do you have? Increasing number of infections and cancers. So now you can see there is a connection between abortion, grief, depression, immune system, and poor general health. Now these are the findings from our study, which are good, I think, and they are supported by other studies. For instance, Humphreys in England found that if you looked at the number of visits to a family doctor before and after an abortion, the number of visits to a family doctor after an abortion go up, for physical reasons goes up 80%, and for psychosocial reasons goes up 180%. So once again, in terms of medical dollars, you can understand that this is a very expensive thing. We're making women unhealthy with abortions. Okay, next one. Here is just some data to show of a comparison between miscarriages and abortions, and you can see that prolonged grieving is more likely to occur almost twice as often in abortions than miscarriages. This, in light of the fact that the actual average duration of a pregnancy in a miscarriage is longer than the average pregnancy of an abortion. Of course, the length of the pregnancy has obviously something to do with the length of the amount of attachment and the degree of grieving. So that all other factors, it looks like the grieving for an abortion takes twice as long or twice as much effort compared to a miscarriage. All right, next one, please. This is to show you that the difficulty, the grieving, the problems surrounding an abortion are cumulative. That is, you never get used to having an abortion. And one adds to the other in the next one. So it's an accumulative effect, and the more abortions in effect, the sicker general health the woman will have. Next one, please. Now, if you look at a whole range of factors that will determine whether a woman will abort her pregnancies, what you find, in fact, is the amount of partner support is by far the most important. A whole series of zeros like that mean that that possibility of happening by chance is less than 1 in 10,000. So partner support, by far, is the most important factor that will determine whether a woman has an abortion or not. What I won't show you here, but we also have, is data to show that if a woman is not supported by her partner, she also has a much higher chance of having a miscarriage. Now, for people in Queensland, if you're raised on a farm, that's not a surprise. If you don't look after the sow or the cow, they miscarry, don't they? They have to be supported. So this is a psychobiological phenomenon. It's very important to be supported by your partner. And in fact, there's evidence to show that substituting some other person in the family doesn't work. It has to be a partner. And I guess that's the way it was supposed to be. Now, the crazy thing about your government, my government, our legal system, and your legal system is that it does its very best to undermine the amount of partner support. How does it do this? If a man goes to court and says, I want you, the court, to stop my partner from having an abortion, what happens? He's thrown out in his year. Every attempt so far by men to stop their wives or their partners having an abortion has failed. In fact, men have no legal right in the determination of an unborn baby. Now, many studies have shown that if there is a chance that the person will die, you don't attach. And one of the things that psychiatrists have known for a long time is that premature babies, which have a higher risk of dying, are not as well bonded to their mothers. Their mothers don't attach. Modern obstetrics and pediatrics units try very hard now to make sure that the baby has a chance to be cuddled and nursed by the mother, so there is bonding. But in any case, your experience and the medical experience will show that if there's a chance somebody will die, you don't allow yourself to attach. So the husband now is confronted with a situation where his wife, without his awareness or consent, may abort their baby. Knowing that, he's not going to allow himself to attach to the unborn baby. He won't become involved in the pregnancy. He won't talk to her tummy. And if he doesn't become involved in the pregnancy, she feels unsupported, increases her chances of having an abortion, increases his chance of not supporting her, and so it goes around in a vicious circle. And the government doesn't seem to realize that by undermining partner support, they are increasing the number of abortions in a very large number, large percentage. Okay, the next one, please. This is to show that this the importance of partner support doesn't diminish right up until the sixth pregnancy. That is, women never get used to not being supported by their partner during a pregnancy. It increases many times. If the partner is present and not supportive, she is 600% more likely to abort her baby. If the partner is absent, she is 800% more likely to abort her baby. So this is a huge factor. You don't need statistics to show you it's significant. Next one, please. Now, what happens here, why you ask yourself, why do teenagers abort their babies? And obviously, it's because so very few of them have any kind of partner support. And you can see that the partner support in the 20 to 25-year bracket goes up a great deal, and of course, goes up. But it's the teenagers who don't have any kind of partner support. And it's because they don't have partner support and they're not encouraged to have partner support that they're more likely to abort their babies. Next one, please. What I would like to emphasize, of course, if you're thinking of any kind of preventive program with respect to abortion, the thing you've got to aim at is the partner support. You've got to increase the partner support, and if you increase the partner support, you diminish the number of abortions considerably. Now, we ask these people who have come to see their family doctors for headaches and colds and backaches and all sorts of other things. How many of you at this point in time would like professional help to deal with your pregnancy loss? Remembering that the pregnancy loss following an abortion is more difficult than a pregnancy loss of other kinds. So approximately 30% of all the women in a family practice would say at this point in time, I need professional help to deal with my pregnancy loss. That is a huge number of people, an enormous number of people, and it's generally going unrecognized. Now, we did this study together with the College of Family Practice in our country to point out that doctors are generally ignoring the impact of pregnancy losses, particularly abortion, and they can't do this. 30% of the people in their practice at any point in time want professional help to deal with their pregnancy loss, particularly abortion. Now, if you say people don't want to talk about their abortion, I say it's just not true. And when I talk to medical students and psychiatric registrars, what do I say? When you're doing a history, make sure you ask about all the kinds of pregnancy outcomes. And if you say to a woman, please tell me about your pregnancy outcomes, she's going to say, well, I have two children. And then you say, no, I want to know about all your pregnancy outcomes. Well, I have two children and a miscarriage. No, I want to know about all your pregnancy outcomes. You just persist. And then she'll say, I have two children, one miscarriage and an abortion. At that point in time, she will cry. Why? Because you're the first person who has shown any interest in the abortion. It's not that people are afraid and don't want to talk about their abortion. It's that we're afraid to listen. And I can tell you, flying across the Pacific Ocean in a 747, I'm standing at the back of this airplane late in the night talking to a stewardess about her abortion. I didn't bring up the subject. It's just, if you're willing to listen, people will talk about it. They need to talk about it. They know they need to talk about it. So let's look at the problems regarding grieving with respect to pregnancy losses, particularly abortion. As you know, with respect to grieving, it's very important to see and preferably touch the body of the dead person. And when soldiers are killed overseas, your government brings the bodies back, not just because you want a piece of the body in the native soil, it's because the widow needs to see that body and preferably touch that body. Then she is absolutely convinced he's dead, not missing, not a prisoner, and she can begin grieving. And in obstetrics unit, in every western part of the world that I know of, a stillborn baby is given to the mother, and she touches it, caresses it, counts all the fingers and toes, holds it close to it. The baby is handled by the father. They name the baby, they bury the baby, and then they can grieve the baby. Now you can see the problem with an abortion. They don't see the baby, they don't get to touch the baby, and it's very hard to start the grieving process. So it's very important that people understand that this is one of the reasons that makes abortion grieving far more difficult than any other kind of grieving. The other very important factor is that in an abortion, you contribute to the death. Now, I say contribute because I don't want people who have an abortion to think that they're murderers. The murderer is, in fact, the abortionist. Granted, he's a hired gun. And once again, they have absolutely no illusions, because I know a number of ex-abortionists that are under absolutely no illusions about what they're doing. They do not think they are helping women. They know that. In fact, most of the abortionists I know do not like women. They often hate them. And when we did a survey of this, I can tell you this in confidence, when you do a survey of the abortionists, why do they say they're doing it? Frankly, power and money. And I can show you a videotape of two ex-abortionists and husband and wife team, and they're talking to each other, and one says to the other, do you remember anybody ever saying thank you for the abortion? No, she says, I can't. In all their years of doing abortion, nobody said thank you. Now I ask you, would you continue a practice where your patients never said thank you? You'd have to begin to wonder what you're doing. So they're under no illusions about what's going on here. Absolutely none. Now, the other factor, of course, is that the woman contributes to the death of the baby. And if in fact or in fantasy you contribute to the death of somebody you now must mourn, it makes the grieving difficult. It makes it pathological grief. So you're driving through the streets of Brisbane with your best friend by your side, and out of nowhere comes a car and kills your best friend. It makes a lot of difference to the grieving process if you were driving through a red light or a green light. Correct? So even people who in fantasy contribute to the death, and that's why women who fantasize about the death of their baby and then have a miscarriage are caught up in part of this pathological grieving process. The third factor that makes grieving an abortion very difficult is that there is no social support. If your grandmother dies or your husband dies, they say, that's too bad. Let's talk about it. Take a few days off. But there's absolutely no support for grieving an abortion. In fact, people make you feel you're crazy, because after all, it was a non-event. Why should you be upset about a non-event? In addition to that fact, the professions do not seem to show any interest in women who want to grieve their abortion. You go to the average doctor and they don't want to talk about it. Why? Because they are often implicated. And until people deal with their personal implications and contributing to the death of unborn babies, it's very hard for them to listen to the pain women have when they're talking about their abortion. So that's why it's so important for me and Dr. Arthur Hartwig and others to get doctors, particularly doctors, to talk about it from their hearts so they can deal with their personal implications, so they can then hear the pain of post-abortion women. The fourth factor is that you cannot mourn a carrot. You have to mourn or a tissue or a fetus. You have to mourn a person. So the baby was dehumanized in order to abort it, and now you have to do the very painful thing of rehumanizing this baby. This was a real person. A real person, and you knew that person. Now, you ask any person that's had a miscarriage, stillbirth, or a miscarriage and abortion, if they knew that person, they will tell you, yes, I know who that person was. I'll tell you who the sex was. I can tell you what they looked like if they grew up. I'll even give you a name. And the beautiful thing is you can get husbands and wives who never talk to each other about this to agree 100% on the characteristics of the child. Boy, girl, blonde, tall, and even agree on the name. Now, how is it that this baby leaves such an indelible imprint when they're only here for such a short period? Well, you can explain part of that scientifically. After all, a baby in a mother's womb is the most intimacy, greatest intimacy humans ever know. They're basically two cells apart. They're constantly monitoring each other's biology, biochemistry, and each other's emotions. Every mother knows that baby, and every baby leaves an indelible imprint in the mother's mind. So now you have to engage in the difficult process of rehumanizing the baby in order to see it as a person so you can grieve it. But that's very hard to do if you yourself have been dehumanized by child abuse and neglect. And so we teach a course, and I'm glad to see Marion here and Arthur Hartwig, who are part of the course we just put on here, and they will tell you about the course. The course is an arduous program of dealing with the dehumanizing influences of child abuse and child neglect in order to rehumanize the person so they can rehumanize the baby, so they can see it as a person, so they can now start grieving. And so there are very, very important factors, five important factors that make grieving and abortion the most difficult kind of grief there is. And in the face of this, you would think that the country would put some money into this, if for no other reason, to save money in the long run, because these people are going to cost a lot of money, because they keep turning up in family doctors and asking for pills for their headaches, they can't sleep, etc. And if they deal with the grief of the abortion, then they won't keep turning up, and there you're going to have a smaller health bill. Now, the next one, please. I want to tell you that this is a point estimate. The point estimate, that is, if you asked anybody in this audience how many of you have a cold, or maybe two or three people would say, yes, we have a cold, that's a point estimate. If I said, have you ever had a cold? Well, almost everybody would put up their hand, wouldn't they? And so this point estimate of 30% is an indication of how at any one point in time people need help to deal with their abortion, professional help to deal with their pregnancy loss. But if you ask a different question, have you ever needed professional help to deal with your pregnancy loss? Who knows? Maybe nearly 100%. What we do know is that 100% of the women do need to grieve. And sometimes they can accomplish this on their own, but sometimes it may take many years. And we followed up, we have a follow-up study in a abortion helpline in Canada, and we've looked at the interval between when the abortion occurred and when people phone up to get help to deal with their abortion. 43 years later, people are phoning up and say, I've got to deal with my abortion. So it never goes away. All right, so here's the evidence that I was suggesting shows that the lack of partner support, whether they're present or supportive or whether they're absent, has a great influence not only in the number of abortions but actually on the number of miscarriages. So any government who is thinking about diminishing the number of abortions, diminishing the health care budget, will do all it can to increase partner support. Next one, please. Now, this shows you the connection between a pregnancy that ended in a first pregnancy that ended in abortion and the later percentage of miscarriage. The evidence that we have, and I think it's a reasonably good study, shows that the number of miscarriages are almost doubled by having an abortion of the first pregnancy. And that's not just because of bad abortion techniques that result in cervical incompetence. It's because of other factors such as circulating antibodies. And as you probably know, the maternal circulation is contaminated by the cells, both blood cells and tissue cells, of the aborted baby during the pregnancy. That is, the mother's circulation takes up these cells. And that's why she is sensitized. Now, just to digress here a little bit and to tell you that the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, which is a not what you would call fair on some of these issues like regarding abortion reporting, recently put out a memo stating there has been an alarming increase in the number of deaths associated with abortionists trying to abort a baby that is in fact an ectopic pregnancy. The ectopic pregnancy occurs very frequently because of scarring of the tubes. The scarring of the tubes occurs because there has been a fulminating infection by chlamydia. Chlamydia is present in 43% of sexually active American women. And if it's not treated, at least 50% of them have a PID, and a large percentage of them have scarring of their tubes, and therefore you get ectopic pregnancies. So what in fact has now happened in the United States? It is now standard practice that if a woman is to have an abortion, she first must have an ultrasound to make sure that the baby is in the uterus and not in the tubes, because if you try to do an abortion when the baby's in the tubes, you're going to kill the woman. The difficulty, of course, is that if you do an ultrasound, now you're confronted with a dilemma. Do you let the woman see the ultrasound? And if she sees the ultrasound, experience has shown that 80 to 100% of those women change their mind. And so what abortionists do is they do the ultrasound, but they don't let the woman see it. Because otherwise she would bond to this baby and say, no, I don't want to have an abortion. The second thing is the doctors must check for a chlamydia infection, and if there's a chlamydia infection, he must treat for that chlamydia infection before doing an abortion. And the third factor, of course, is he must check to see if the mother is Rh negative. Otherwise, she's probably going to have anti-Rh antibodies in her circulation, which will damage and possibly miscarry the subsequent baby. So these three things are now standard abortion techniques. So that if an abortionist is not doing these three things, it is a substandard medical procedure open to litigation. And you will find there's an abortionist in the United States, an active an abortionist, who will testify against his colleagues who practice substandard abortions. It's just medical incompetence. All right, next one, please. What happens here is that here's graphical information to show you that the best predictor of the outcome in the second pregnancy is the outcome in the first pregnancy. That is, any obstetrician family doctor has got to make sure that the outcome of the first pregnancy is a full-term, happy, a full birth weight baby. Because otherwise, the outcome is very likely to be a different outcome. So 50% in this instance, 50% of the women who had an abortion in the first pregnancy have an abortion in their second pregnancy. Now, why would a woman who had the pain of an abortion ever think of having another abortion? There are all sorts of reasons for it. Very few of them are socioeconomic. It has to do with why don't we learn from our tragic history? Why don't humans learn from their tragic history? Why do people who've been abused as children end up becoming those who abuse their own children? And it's very briefly a little bit like this. The human organism has to be efficient. It must maintain a positive energy state or die in entropy. And to do that, it must resolve conflicts because conflicts eat up energy uselessly. Now, if you are trying to understand a conflict, you have three possible ways of doing that. You can sit and think about it. Now, why do I keep doing this? Or you can talk to your favorite psychiatrist or your favorite friend, and together you may be able to work out, why do I keep doing this? But most importantly, when it surrounds major trauma like child abuse and abortion, people will reenact it. They will restage it in an effort to understand it. So curiously enough, tragic repetitions of history are not just tragic repetitions of history. They are a unconscious, subconscious, an attempt to understand why it happened in the first instance. In any case, what is very important here is to understand that the outcome of the first pregnancy is the best predictor of the outcome of the second pregnancy. And if you want a woman to have a good pregnancy history, then you want to make sure she has a good outcome in her first pregnancy. Okay, next one. Now, here's something that we get medical students to think about. Bright young medical students, how do you explain this? It shows, in fact, that those who approve of abortion, that's a woman's right, have a higher miscarriage rate. Why should that be? Is there some way the fetus, the unborn baby, understands that? Don't know, but he's got the medical student scratching his head, and there are a few slivers under his fingernails. Next one. But you want to think about that, because there are some things that are still worth investigating. Now, one of the studies, as I said, were just the people who come into a normal family practice in our city. And another part of our study, an additional 600 or 700 people, were a sample collected from the CMDS, the Christian Medical and Dental Society in Canada. And what you find here is something that I hope you're not surprised to find, is that the abortion rate among CMDS members is much lower than the average family doctor. Well, that's kind of reassuring to know that. But what is interesting also is to note that the miscarriage rate is also lower among Christian doctors. And it may be because the Christian doctors are more supportive. Who knows? But it's nice to know that there is evidence that being a Christian makes a difference. It can be measured in terms of pregnancy outcome. Okay, the next one. Now, this is a little bit of a crude drawing, but in the world at large, if you're thinking about bad things happening to people, you have a perpetrator, P, doing terrible things to the victim, V. And under most instances, the perpetrator is a terribly evil person who should be locked up, and the victim is totally innocent and needs to be compensated or commiserated with. In actual fact, this is not true. There is substantial evidence of all kinds to show, and I say this very carefully, that the victim may contribute to their own victimization. And I said this in the audience at the Mater Hospital just a few days ago. These are people who are specializing in child abuse, and you can see their eyebrows go right up. It is not politically correct. I understand that. However, it is scientific, and I'm sorry about that. But the victim may contribute to their own victimization, even some children. And that is tragic. That is not to excuse the perpetrators, but it is a fact. In fact, one of the studies that supports this is a study of people who are mugged on the streets of Chicago. And the question is, why do some people continually, repeatedly get mugged and other people never do? It turns out, if you analyze the victims, you find the people who get mugged on the streets of Chicago are those who walk down the street as if they're lost or dazed or confused. But if you walk down the streets of Chicago making out like you know where you're going and you know all the people around you, you don't get mugged. Now, that's a piece of useful advice when you go to Chicago or New York. Make out like you look so you know where you're going, and you won't likely get mugged. But if you stand on the street corner and look around in a dazed fashion, you're increasing the chances of getting mugged considerably. And anybody who's run foster homes or run child psychiatric unit or anything like that knows that there is a propensity on the part of children, sadly, who have been physically abused to be very physically irritating. And those who have been verbally abused to be verbally provocative. and those who've been sexually abused to be sexually provocative. That is tragic. That is not to excuse perpetrators. It's just one of the tragedies. Now, if I see a woman who has been sexually abused by her stepfather, who is she most angry at? Her mother. And if she went to her mother and said, "Mother, why did you let this happen?" The mother will say, "I didn't see it, and I couldn't have done anything about it." And you ask the victim, the young woman, and she say, "I can remember telling my mother," or "she should have known." And you ask teachers, "Did you see those children coming into the class looking depressed or disheveled or neglected or bruised?" "No, I don't remember that." And if you go to Bosnia, not so long ago, Marie and I were in Bosnia, we were training people there, you find everybody hates everybody. The Turks, the Muslims hate the Serbians, and the Serbians hate the Croatians, and the Croatians hate themselves and everybody else. Everybody hates each other, and have done so since the 6th century, which is when the Croatian people moved into that part of the world. But who do they hate more than anybody else? They hate the UN observers. They literally spit on them. And in fact, the Australian and Canadian soldiers, when they leave the airport and spit, they yank off their shoulder badges, their UN shoulder badges. They are so ashamed. Now, throughout history, I think you can know that the main responsibility has been that of the observer, because they have an opportunity to see what's going on and they're not involved directly. Who are the observers? Us. Absolutely. And if you want to do any work in child abuse and abortion, you will find enormous anger at social workers, pastors, physicians, all sorts of people who should have and could have done something but did not. Enormous anger, and enormous anger at politicians. "Why did you let this happen?" And the politicians are going to say, like every observer does, "I didn't know what was happening. Besides, how could I do anything to stop it?" Is enormous residue of anger at the observers. Pastors in particular, priests, and the whole range of observers. Enormous anger when it comes down to abortion. Because deep in their heart, they know the observer could have made a difference. And we are the observers. And let me tell you one horrendous story so you will not forget this point. This is a young woman who was sexually abused when she was young. And she married a wonderful young man, an Asian, and they had three beautiful Eurasian children, really beautiful children. She was getting tired of the fact that her husband was always working, so she left the marriage and joined a man who was very romantic. And one evening, her teenage daughter, beautiful daughter, came and said, "Mommy, I'm bleeding." So she said, "Oh, I better take you to the doctor. I suspect what's going on here." She took the child to the doctor, who did a vaginal examination and showed no cause for the bleeding. So the mother said to the daughter, "You're making this all up." So the abuse continued, the sexual abuse. What was the doctor's fault? Well, I give you a clue. The mother was having an affair with her husband's lover. Come on, you psychiatrist. Come on, medical student. What was going on here? The man was bisexual. He was doing anal intercourse. And the doctor looked in the wrong orifice. And was she angry at the doctor? Oh, she was so angry at the doctor and her mother, the observers. So I don't want you ever to forget that it's the observers in situations of child abuse and neglect, in situations of abortion, where the anger is really directed. And if you ask the woman what she think about the abortionist, well, he was just doing his job. Kind of a job is that? But who's she angry at? She's angry at her husband, or her boyfriend. She's angry at doctors and nurses and social workers and pastors and politicians. Why would you let this happen? Okay, next one, please. So this is a model, a triangle of tragic triangle of abuse and neglect. Now I want to put that up and just bring it down so they can read the print. This comes out the illustrated textbook of medical history. And it shows a riot on the streets or on the docks in New York. And these people are trying to stop a ship from offloading potential cholera carriers. Because the medical authorities didn't think it was a big problem, but the public thought it was a big problem. which is a historical precedent to say if the medical profession is not going to deal with an epidemic, then the people. The parallel, of course, is if the doctors and the politicians are not going to deal with the epidemic of abortion, you can't blame people for wanting to protest, stand outside clinics. And there's historical precedent for that. Doctors, if you won't take your responsibility, we'll do what we can to stop this. Now, I said epidemic, and I say this very, very carefully. There are approximately 60 million abortions in the world every year. So discounting the number of repeats, let's say there are 50 million. 50 million new damaged patients, women. And the damage to women isn't much greater than the damage to the men. So that's another 50 million. And there are another 100 million children. And I want to talk about how children are damaged. That's an epidemic of 200 million new patients every year. And there has been nothing like it in the history of humankind. And nobody seems to be taking it seriously. And that's a very, very sad fact. By conservative estimates, 50% of all Australian women by the age of 45 have had at least one abortion. And in the United States, it's 70%. And in the Ukraine, it's 90%. And in China, it's probably 100%. That's a huge number of deeply damaged people. And it's going to have an immense impact on the health care budget, if nothing else. But let me talk a little bit now. Do you want to shut that off? Oh, no, let's go on a little bit more. Let's the connection between abuse and abortion. Well, years and years ago, a woman came into my office and said, "Doctor, I have a young child here, my only little daughter, and she is feeling awful because she can't sleep. And the reason she can't sleep is she has a recurrent nightmare. And the recurrent nightmare keeps her awake. And the recurrent nightmare was of three little siblings that had gone off with her to play in a bank of sand. They tumbled into the sand, and the sand had collapsed and buried her three little siblings. She couldn't tell me who they were, but she was very, very worried about them. So I turned to the mother, and this was her only child, and I said, "How many pregnancies?" And the mother said, "I'd had three early miscarriages the child could not have known about." But it surfaces in the child's dream. Another mother told me that she had a beautiful pregnancy, a lovely delivery, and this was a lovely child, and she had a supportive husband and a beautiful home, but she couldn't touch this baby. And I looked at all the factors. This was years and years ago when I was young. And the only factor that stood out was that she had had an abortion in her previous pregnancy. So that alerted me to the fact there may be a connection between abortion and abuse. Well, we've checked this out, and here are some of the features. This is a study of abused children, and these are the most important factors that determine whether a child is abused. Now, let me just go back slightly and talk a bit about the post-abortion syndrome. So the major feature of that is unresolved or pathological grief. The other is guilt. And if you think guilt has something to do with your morality, your theology, or what pro-lifers tell you you should feel, it's not true. Every species has a built-in biological mechanism that alerts them to the fact they should not kill their own young. That has to be so. Otherwise, species would destroy their own young. They get hungry. But there is a built-in restraint. Now, if in some manner we overcome that or damage that restraint, obviously we're exposing our young to a vast problem that may endanger the whole species. But think about it. Now we have a problem of grief and guilt and fear. Because the thing that you fear more than anything else, believe it or not, is your own aggression, not the aggression of other people. And if you won't own up to your own aggression, you tend to project this into other people. Now, it's not easy to kill a person. There is a built-in restraint to humans killing their own young or killing their own kind. And you will know this because many nights when a baby has wakened you up at 3 o'clock in the morning and you feel what? Irritation. Stupid little kid, go back to sleep. But immediately that aggression is dampened by an instinctual restraint. And then you think, the poor little thing is wet, cold, or hungry, and I'll look after it. But what if we weaken that instinctual restraint to that momentary aggression? We are endangering the whole species. What is evidence to this? In the United States, the most common cause of death to children 6 years and younger are not accidents, infections, or cancers. It is infanticide. So now we've done something that damages the instinctual restraint to aggression. So we now have a post-abortion syndrome that consists of grief, guilt, and fear of your own aggression, and anger. The anger, of course, comes because somebody has let you down in a critical situation. If you're dangling off the end of a rope when you're climbing and your friend lets you down, you never forgive him. And it's like that with women who are having a pregnancy. It's a critical situation and you want your partner to be there. And if they're not, you feel enormously angry. Now, this comes to be a natural anger. Now, men and women have always been in a state of tension. But now we have a factor that's increasing this tension, increasing the anger of women to men and men to women. Women to men because men are letting women down. Men to women because they have no say in the outcome of the pregnancy. Now, believe you, there's a huge residue of rage in men because they have no legal right to restrain the women from having an abortion of their baby. So now you have a residue, a great possible conflagration of men and women. And you can see it's heating up. And the outcome is always bad for the baby, because the baby gets scapegoated for that. All right, coming back to child abuse and abortion. There is this statistical connection. That is, women who have had an abortion are statistically more likely to abuse and neglect their children. That is not to say women who have had an abortion are always bad mothers. It's just not true. But there is a statistical connection, and it must make you wonder. And so I told the people at Mater Hospital, look, if you're thinking about dealing with the precipitating factors regarding child abuse, one of the things you've got to think about is diminishing the number of abortions and helping people grieve their abortions. Because the connection is this. Women who've had an abortion are more likely to be anxious during a subsequent pregnancy. And if you're anxious, you're likely to think your unborn baby is abnormal. And therefore, you have to repeatedly go to the doctor and say, I want another ultrasound. Doctor, I must be sure my baby's normal. And what is the doctor going to say? Sure, I'm absolutely sure your baby's normal. No doctor worth his salt will ever say that. You could be sued for millions for wrongful life if you make a mistake. So a doctor is going to equivocate, is he not? Well, I think it's all right. And if your doctor says, I think it's all right, what do you suspect? He's hiding something. And therefore, you get even more anxious, and you want more tests. And again, it increases the healthcare budget. So, if the woman is more anxious because of an unresolved pregnancy loss, particularly an abortion, she thinks her baby's going to be abnormal. And I have evidence, at least clinical evidence, to show that if a woman thinks her baby is abnormal, she's going to have real problems with the third stage of labor. And this comes from a friend of mine, a colleague in Budapest who runs a birthing center. Pushing that baby out is very difficult because you think the baby may be abnormal and you want high tech there available so that the baby will be resuscitated if there's anything wrong. The second factor is that if you've had an unresolved pregnancy loss, particularly an abortion, you're more likely to be depressed on the birth of the subsequent pregnancy. This means that if you're depressed, you do not bond as well. And everybody in the area of child abuse knows that if the baby is not as well bonded, they're more likely to be abused and neglected. Third factor is the baby is not going to be held as often. And if the baby is not as held as often, they're not going to be breastfed as often. In one country in which we've shown a change in the breastfeeding rate before and after the introduction of a one-child policy, before that, the breastfeeding rate was 87%. After the introduction of that policy, it was 18.7%. That's an immense factor. So we're doing something now that interferes with the general health of people. Because as you may or may not know, breast milk is about the only place a baby can get essential fatty acids. Essential fatty acids are necessary for the building of your brain. 40% of your brain is made up of essential fatty acid and your myelin sheaths. So it literally And you can refer to a Lancet article. If you were not breastfed, you're not as smart as you were designed to be. So now, if you are diminishing the rate of breastfeeding, you're actually interfering with the intelligence of a whole nation. And what does that? Abortion. The fourth factor is, as I suggested, there tends to be an abnormal response to a baby's cry when women had an unresolved pregnancy loss, particularly an abortion. They're more likely to respond with feelings of helplessness and irritation. And the helplessness results in neglect, and the irritation tends to result in physical abuse. So now you're beginning to understand some of the factors that connect abortion with child abuse. What about the other way? Because the other way is true also. That is, women who have been abused, physical, verbal, sexual abuse, and neglected as children are more likely to have abortions. And the reasons are very simply these. If you were neglected as a child, you are very sensitive to abandonment by your partner. And all he has to say is, look, lady, you must make a choice, me or the baby. And how are you going to choose? For him, because you do not want to be abandoned, because you know what it's like in your experience as a child. Secondly, if you're neglected, your body and your mind are not as resilient. And I want to remind you that every pregnancy is a crisis pregnancy. It's a crisis, a kairos, an opportunity to change, to grow. And you may reject that opportunity to grow because, in fact, you're afraid of becoming an adult, and for all sorts of other reasons. And so a body and a mind that were not well nurtured when you were young is more fragile, and therefore you tend to reject this crisis of incorporation, this opportunity to grow. The fourth factor has to be the fact that many women who have been abused and neglected know in their hearts that it's going to be much harder for them to be a good parent. And so they say, I will not subject my baby to the kind of mistreatment I had, and therefore I will prevent the mistreatment by aborting the baby. Sounds illogical, but believe me, people think that way. So, in fact, there are many connections why abortion increases the incidence of child abuse and neglect, and why child abuse and neglect leads to abortion. Okay, next feature. So here's some data to show this connection. Believe me, whenever I have talked about this in whatever audience, people get quite angry. They don't like to think there's a connection between child abuse and abortion, because after all, it was argued for many years that if you had freely available abortions, there would be no unwanted children. If you didn't have unwanted children, there would be less child abuse. There's no evidence, absolutely none, to support this. The best evidence in countries that have collected statistics on child abuse and neglect for a number of years is that the rate of child abuse and neglect is increasing, not decreasing. All right. Next. And this whole idea of wantedness. Now, all right, medical student, it is said that the first right of every child is to be wanted, correct? No. The corollary, of course, if the first right of every child is to be wanted, then if you're not wanted, you have no right to be. Logical? And that logic is not lost on children. And that statement, the first right of every child is to be wanted, is a statement penned by Margaret Sanger, the birth mother of International Planned Parenthood Federation. It has now become a byword in the United Nations. Every child a wanted child. What is it like to think that you're alive because you're wanted? You ask somebody from a concentration camp how it feels to be alive because you're wanted. It's horrible. It's a horrible feeling. Because you have to begin to wonder, what happens if I become unwanted? What if I become old and infirm, or I'm hit by a car and disabled, or I become sick and I become unwanted? My life is in jeopardy. And now we have a whole world filling with people who are wanted children, and all of them are wondering, what happens if I become unwanted? And if your existence depends upon being wanted, then you have to wonder what happens if you're unwanted, and you're going to have to wonder, how is my wantedness in compared to other people? And so you're always constantly looking over your shoulder and putting other people down. because you want to stay relatively wanted. And you have no intrinsic value. Your value is extrinsic. It depends upon how people value you, how much they want you. And so constantly you have to wonder if you're popular. And politicians, what? They want to know what the opinion poll shows. It's very hard to be a statesman and say, I've got to do this regardless of what the public says. And so you can understand that suddenly being wanted and being popular is very important. It has, after all, determined whether you live or die. So let me now get, and this is just a little graph to show you that there is no relationship between unwantedness and child abuse. In fact, there is a connection between wantedness and child abuse. That is, curiously enough, wanted children are more frequently abused. Should that surprise you? Absolutely not. Because if you're a wanted child, you have to live up to the expectations of the person who wanted you. And what happens if you fail their expectations? Then they want to change you. They want to direct you. They want to punish you to make you come up to their expectations. So curiously, there is no connection between unwantedness and child abuse. If there's any connection, it's a negative correlation. All right, the next, or the other is to show that wantedness changes in time. At the beginning, before a woman is pregnant, yes, I would like a baby. In the first stages of her pregnancy, oh man, is she ambivalent. After all, she got morning sickness, and the husband's wondering about whether he's going to have to take another job. And so the ambivalence increases, the wantedness diminishes, and it's that point that people are persuaded to have an abortion. They're taking advantage of a woman's ambivalence. And I want to remind you, particularly young medical students, I want to remind you that everybody is ambivalent about everything almost all the time, particularly about doctors. Anyhow, next. And just to bring this home, we looked at many, many factors that may have to do between child abuse and abortion, and wantedness does not occur except as a negative correlation. Next one, please. Well, we did that one. Let's stop right there. Okay. Now, what is it like to grow up in a family knowing or strongly suspecting that your mother aborted one of your siblings? But terrifying. Terrifying. The deepest of anxiety of any child is an anxiety about being eaten by your parents. You look at children's stories and Grimm's fairy tales and Hans Christian Andersen, and how many drawings children have of things filled with many teeth, and they're fascinating for Tyrannus and all those dinosaurs. They're terrified about being eaten. And abortion is a kind of being eaten. So it reaches at the child's very deepest anxiety. My parents not only have the capability of killing me, but they could, because they've already done it with one of my siblings. Now you may ask, well, do children know about abortions in their family? They do, or very, very strongly suspect. The problem is they don't go to the mothers and ask, because it's too terrifying to know. I mean, they really don't want to know that my mother had, or my father had, the capacity to kill me. So what is it like to grow up in a family knowing that your parents have aborted one of your siblings? It's an awful situation. We call these people abortion survivors, and they have these problems. They have survivor guilt. The people coming from the concentration camps in Nazi Germany, how did they feel if they survived? Glad to meet every dawn? No. They felt guilty about existing. And there were high rates of depression and suicide that even affected their children. So knowing that you're alive when other people near and dear to you were killed creates this existential, this survivor guilt. It makes it difficult for you to live your life. Not only that, you distrust your parents. After all, they killed one of your little siblings. And I want to say that John Bowlby has pointed out that in situations where father and mothers are likely to divorce each other, siblings become increasingly important. And it's very important to children what happens to their siblings. Not only that, the children not only distrust the parents, but parental figures, authority figures. Who was supposed to protect me? My parents? The judge? The government? And they let me down? I don't trust judges, police, government or anything. Not only is this phenomenal distrust, but there is underneath it an enormous rage. But you can't express this rage because your parents have to look after you. So, by a mechanism known as reaction formation, you look after the person. And it's very interesting that survivors, abortion survivors, are very doting on their parents and look after them very far into their old age. At the same time, there is, at a much deeper level, this immense rage. Not only that, abortion survivors don't want to have children. And in your country, in our country, what's the current birth rate? About 1.7 in Canada per couple. And replacement is 2.1. And the only way we keep our economy going, because you cannot have a free market economy with a declining population, the only way we keep our economy up is by importing people. In Canada, which reputedly has the highest standard of living in the world, we can do that. We can invite people to come there, and we check them out. Do they have money, intelligence, or skills? And so we drain other countries from their best resource, build our economy because it's an increasing population, increases the standard of living, making it more attractive. That's terrible, isn't it? Psychopaths, really. Draining other countries of their best resources and keeping our population going. But you know that in European countries, for instance, in France, which has a birth rate of about 1.5, among French people, kept up to 1.7 by people who come from Algeria. Why? Because the Algerians are populating, they're having lots of children. It's creating enormous tension. And in Germany, it's the Turks. And in many other countries, it's minority groups that keep the population up, but creating enormous tension between ethnic groups and a lot of backlash. In any case, there are these abortion survivors, and they are feeling the effects, but they don't know quite how this came about, and they don't know to what to attribute this. And when I go to young people and I talk about being wanted and I talk about being abortion survivors, boy, you watch their eyes light up. And suddenly they stop chit-chat and they become very serious because they know what I'm talking about. In any case, there are immense number of these abortion survivors in the world. And they tend to be careless with their world, with their lives. They tend to be reckless and suicidal. They tend to be uncaring, disrespectful, and they don't want to have children. And so we now set in motion with this thing called abortion, things that affect the government, the medical profession, mothers and fathers and grandparents and children. It's a social experiment without any kind of social engineering. There's no engineer. It's madness. And I say to my friends, and I've had the opportunity to speak in the House of Lords in London and the Canadian Parliament, I say, look, all you have to say is, of course we support abortions. Of course we will fund abortions when and if they have proven efficacy and safety. Because it has to be controlled like every other area of medicine. There is no area of medicine, in Canada at least, where people can go and say, I want this facelift. Or they could go and say, my arm is hurting, would you chop it off? Doctors have absolutely no obligation to give a patient what they desire. Their only obligation is to give the patient what is good for them by proven efficacy. And in our country, it's called evidence-based medicine. And you want to believe it. Evidence-based medicine applies to every area of medicine, whether it's pills or surgical procedures or psychiatric procedures, except abortion. And the question is, why has abortion become a thing off to the side? And why do medicine own it when it's obviously not regulated and controlled like every other area of medicine? Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention. I'm glad I didn't see you go to sleep and nobody slipped out to see what the score was. So, I feel pretty good. And now please ask me questions. Yeah.
Do you have any theories as to the answer about why abortion slips out of the net of our control?
You want to speak this into something that can be picked up?
Thank you.
Why this part of medicine has slipped out from all the other controls that affect medicine. Good question. Well, 300 years before Jesus, there was an old doc and some of his colleagues, and we role-played this when I was invited to the Department of Deontology in the University of Ankara. And so here I am. I'm Hippocrates. And you're Socrates or Pythagoras lying in your couch, and I come in with a silver vial, and I say, I would like you to drink this. And you say, what's in it? And I say, I don't have to tell you. It's going to be good for you. I want to know what's in it. Well, I can tell you it is going to be very good for you. At that point, the Greeks had a dual obligation to treat you if they could and to poison you if they couldn't. Quick and simple. All right? They had a dual obligation to the patient and to the state. And it's very interesting. If you look at the statement of ethics in the USSR, it's exactly the same thing. A dual obligation to the state and to the patient. So now old Socrates here is beginning to be a bit suspicious, particularly because he suspects his wife is having an affair with a young lover and she wants his estate, right? So he's beginning to think, she's paid me a little fee that will hurry you on your way. So I'm spending an enormous amount of time trying to persuade old Socrates here that I'm really trying to help him. And this is the best potion that comes straight out of the most modern apothecary in Alexandria, right? And this knucklehead of Socrates, he can't be persuaded. So finally, I get fed up and I say, by Zeus, by Apollo, by the whole pantheon, I will not poison you. And then old Socrates says, oh, you're really serious about this, okay. So I don't think it happened just like that, but it happened something like that. The doctors began to realize they would never have their patients' confidence if, one, they poisoned them, two, they aborted them. Those are the three major components of the Hippocratic Oath. And so Hippocrates and his fellow doctors swore they would never do this under oath, with the whole pantheon looking down at them. And so for the last 22 centuries, or 24 centuries rather, we have gradually gained the confidence of people that they actually believe that we have their best interests at heart. It's taken 24 centuries. So what do we do now? After all this time to persuade parents, patients that they should cooperate, when we say, take your clothes off, please, I want to examine you, what do we do now? We blow it. Doctors have sex with their patients, they abort their patients, and they poison their patients, undermining all this confidence that has taken 24 centuries to build up. And do you think that's an expensive thing? You bet. Because now the doctors have to practice defensive medicine. And they have to spend a lot of time convincing their patients that they really do have their best interests at heart. Well, so informed consent has suddenly become very important. And I'll give you a case in point. A doctor in Eastern Canada was telling his patient about a surgical procedure. And he wanted to leave nothing out, so he told it graphically. It was so graphically the patient fainted, fell, hit her head, and sued the doctor. So now you have to get informed consent to give informed consent. That's how it's becoming. But anyhow, to answer your question, so now your patients don't cooperate because they trust you. They might cooperate because they like you. And suddenly it becomes important for doctors to be popular rather than credible. And to be popular, of course, you must adhere to popular morality. And it is expressed, at least in the newspaper, that it is popular to be pro-choice. So the doc says, I've got to get on the bandwagon and be pro-choice. So now there's one factor. The other factor, of course, is that too many doctors are implicated, one way or another, by referring patients or not standing up against this very unscientific practice. And once you are implicated, you now have to justify what you've done. There are approximately 53 factors that you need to consider if you're going to make a rational choice about abortion. Do you have time to consider 53 factors? Absolutely not. It would probably take you a year to carefully vet all those factors. So the facts in the matter are almost all choices, so-called free choices, are in fact emotional choices. So you make a decision, the doctor and the patient, we're going to do it. It's convenient. It doesn't take so much time. And now you have to rationalize what you've done. You have to justify what you've done. So there are two factors. One, doctors are trying to be popular because they're no longer credible or trusted. And secondly, you're trying to justify your own implication. And this is why, as I said before, we're trying very hard to get doctors to look at their own heart and deal with their own heart and recognize they have contributed to something that's very damaging to babies and mothers and fathers and other children. But believe me, you've got to get at the heart of the matter. All the lectures I've ever given and all the papers I've ever written hardly have a dent. You've got to get at the heart of these things. Yes, ma'am.
Wondering, with the change of the law in Canada, I understand your Supreme Court struck down the abortion laws.
That's correct.
Have replaced those laws yet? In that time, have you had a significant increase in the amount of abortion? Is that being tallied, and have you done any research on the impact of the community?
It hasn't made any difference. The reason, of course, is that everybody disregarded the law. Previously, it didn't make any impact. People just ignored the law. Why? Because the police and the judges didn't back up the law. And even though you have something on the book, if the police don't back up the law, it's not a law. So, I mean, eventually everybody recognized that it was a law on the book, but it wasn't a law in practice. And the really bad thing about that, if you have a law that nobody backs up, then everybody breaks it and they become a lawbreaker. Now they have to deal with their own conscience. So there is, curiously enough, at least one benefit to not having a law. You don't have people breaking the law. And the other thing, of course, is that what has happened in Canada, we had almost all the abortions done in hospitals. And it contaminated the whole hospital staff. Nurses had to rotate through there, medical students had to help with the abortion, doctors, and it contaminated the whole staff. It contaminated a noble profession. So gradually the abortion industry is now getting out of that and getting into private clinics. You might think that has increased. It don't really increase the number of abortions. But at least it stops contaminating a noble profession. And the people who do abortions are out there. And to some extent, they are spurned and looked down upon, as they should be. So there is a real benefit to having freestanding clinics in a paradoxical, perverse kind of way. And that's the experience in the United States. I mean, for one thing, it's very hard to picket a hospital. I mean, it just doesn't look right. But you can picket an abortion clinic. And there are all sorts of other reasons why freestanding clinics isolate the problem. It's like other things we do in medicine. We try to isolate the problem, get it out of the city. And once you get it out of the city, then you can deal with it better. But don't contaminate a noble profession. It's happened too much already. Yes, sir. There you go. I thought you were Socrates.
Non-statistical. I'll talk to you about that now, won't I? In other words, I can't use a computer. All this evidence. But have you evidence that people who, you say they're all ambivalent about their pregnancies, but they have a feeling, oh, well, I don't like this baby, it's unwanted. Then they spontaneously abort.
Yeah, well, that's what we were showing up here, and this is why I challenged you, my young medical student friend. What is this curious thing?
That's the point.
No, it's not as bad. And one of the things, if you're thinking about RU486, now it's interesting, when the procedure is done under drapes, you don't see it. And when it's done by a member of a has been noble profession, you can say, I didn't do it, he did it. But now you have a pill in your hand, RU486, and you take the pill, you do your abortion, and that increases the guilt exponentially. I am doing my own abortion to myself. Now, the other factor, of course, is that because people are ambivalent about everything almost all the time, people are particularly ambivalent about terminating the pregnancy. And so they, if they're going to do it, RU486, or as they do it in our country, it's called M&M, using methotrexate, what happens then is you tend to delay it. Now you're going to have late abortions because they're going to do it themselves. And yet that's precisely what the feminists want. They want the medical profession out of it. They want to regulate this whole thing by themselves. And I can tell you what's going to happen, of course. If you take an M&M, you kill the baby and then you abort it. Often, as you know, the baby is not aborted by RU486, and though you then have to follow it up with prostaglandin, which precipitates labor. And some of those babies are going to be alive. And what's going to happen to a woman who now aborts her baby in the privacy of her own boudoir or bathroom, and here's this living little thing? What am I going to do with it? I flush it down the toilet? That's my intent, to be rid of it. Or do I take it to the hospital, see if they can resuscitate it? And you can be quite sure the psychiatrists are going to be busy.
Now, we have got IU here on this, very much on the black market, and I don't think you can think it's in here on the black market. But do you have it in British Columbia?
It's coming. And part of the reason, of course, is that people are trying to cut down the costs associated with abortions, of course, if you can provide it with a pill. And the other thing is, my wife points out, she's a pediatrician and geneticist. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? You can go to a hospital and they can do a blood test and say there's something wrong with your baby and then give you a pill. It's like other things, like a headache. You know, it almost becomes legitimate. Something wrong with your baby? Take a pill. The pill, of course, is not to cure your baby, but to abort it. And so there's going to become an increasing pressure. And there's going to be increasing pressure on the government to save money by making sure that all defective children are aborted. Now, one of the things I didn't tell you, when Marie and I were in this first, this impressive conference on Down syndrome, most of which was search and destroy, the woman who is probably the world's leading expert on search and destroy for Down syndrome said that in Denmark, for many years, they've had available diagnostic procedures if you wanted to find out if your baby's Down syndrome or not. Available, free, for many years. The curious thing is that the actual incidence of Down syndrome has gone up rather than down. Now she's scratching her head. What is it? And she had to admit, what happens in Denmark is that quite a number of women want a career, and then they decide they want a family. So by the age of 40, they have a pregnancy, and they're thinking, this may be my only pregnancy. I'm not going to go and find out whether it's Down syndrome or not. So curiously enough, people in this age group are not checking. And of course, paradoxically, the number of Down syndrome has gone up. You know, certainly people have got to recognize, eventually, you can't break the rules. Gravity always applies. If it's not good for your neighbor, it's not good for yourself. And that's partly what is said here in this statement of ethics. Can you think of any situation where your neighbor, you can benefit at the expense of your neighbor? I can't. If it's not good for blacks, it's not good for whites. If it's not good for men, it's not good for women. If it's not good for unborn babies, it is not good for mothers. Now, that's an ethical statement, but I think that's well supported by science. Eventually, you cannot break the rules. Gravity always applies. Okay, more questions. Yes?
It's been my experience in general practice that women that have had a natural miscarriage are often complaining of sort of vague somatic symptoms like tired, just not sort of having enough warmth to get on with what's required in life. A lot of your research is related to women who have abortion. Is there a literature about women
Well, you want to read this article that we wrote, and it's very much the same thing. There has to be grief with a miscarriage, and it's important that people recognize there has to be grief. It's necessary to talk about the baby. It's necessary to humanize the baby. It's not a miscarriage. It's a person with a personality and a name that has to be understood, has to be buried, if not now, at least symbolically, and it has to be grieved. And in the Christian tradition, of course, you have to commit the spirit of that baby, and you want to record all of the baby's names in the family Bible. they are, in fact, a person who is a part of your family. And it has to be seen as such.
There's a literature, the healing of the family tree type literature, which sort of is got some psychology or Christian theology. So, do you have any feeling about that sort of way of dealing?
Kenneth McCall, a friend of mine. I've had long discussions with Kenneth, and on some points I agree, and on some points we just don't know. But when we're doing this with abortions and with miscarried babies, yes, we individualize the child, and really it's amazing. Mothers do not have a problem knowing and reporting who that child was, and fathers so very, very frequently agree who that child was, and so they do the whole process. And if Marion wanted to tell you, she could tell you how it works. But it's an attempt to individualize the child and then help them start grieving. Because you're quite correct. If you don't grieve, you're going to have all sorts of psychosomatic symptoms. Now, one of the things that happens is that we looked at the frequency of calls to this abortion helpline in relation to when the abortion occurred. And I asked Arthur and other people, when is the most frequent number of calls after an abortion? How many months after an abortion? Come on, medical student. Gee, what do they teach kids nowadays? 6 months.